Alrighty, let's go to Revelation. And let me say, thanks to those who filled in for me last week. I really appreciate that. And I'm sure Arpoka did a good job for you on Sunday morning. And I'm sure Lee did a good job for you on Sunday evening. He's still alive and y'all came back, so I'm thinking things are working well. As we move into Revelation again, let me point out something just about the Bible generally. I'm going to have to say this again in the sermon this morning, but it's not terribly earth-shattering. Morning. Sir, ma'am, how are you? You have to remember that the Bible, when it was written, did not have chapter and verse divisions in it. Those things were added later by printers and publishers to help us find quickly the places that we want to find. We want to return to a particular passage. So what that means is some of the divisions that take place in chapters and verses are kind of artificial, and they interrupt the flow of what's going on. This happens a lot. One good example is 1 Corinthians 11:1, which really goes along with everything that Paul was saying in chapter 10. Another one is probably Romans chapter 8 and verse 1, kind of goes along with what he was saying back in chapter 7. So these things happen from time to time, place to place in the Bible. And the guys who were responsible for dividing it up in chapters and verses would probably have done it differently if they'd had a little bit more time to work on it and so on. Anyway, the point to that long excursus is that chapter 17 really goes along with what was going on in chapter 16. And we were looking at chapter 14, 15, and 16 together, and then I just want you to be aware that the break between 16 and 17 is a little bit artificial, because chapter 17 really goes along with what was going on before. We pointed out that in chapter 14, 15, and 16, what we were looking at before was this judgment that had been pronounced upon the Roman Empire because of its persecution of Christians. And then when the chapter opens in chapter 17, we have a little bit more detailed look. And we had seen that process work before too, where, especially in the book of Daniel, God gives a vision and then kind of does it again in a narrower view, and then does it yet again in an even narrower view. And that's kind of what's happening here. So we had this long chapter 14, 15, and 16 talked about the destruction of the Roman Empire because of its persecution of Christians. And now God is going to kind of zero in on one particular aspect of this and turn in chapter 17 and talk about, let's just charge into it. There's just no substitute for the text. You know what I'm saying here? Yeah, just can't beat the Bible. Let's start reading in chapter 17 and verse 1. And we will read down through, let's stop in verse 6. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. With her the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. Anybody remember reading anything like that before? You ever heard about this beast that has seven heads and 10 horns? Anybody remember that? Okay, a couple do. That's good, because we spent a lot of time talking. All right. The woman was dressed, this is verse 4, the woman was dressed in purple and scarlet, was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This title was written on her forehead, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished. We'll just stop there for just a minute. From the very beginning, we're talking about one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls. Remember the seven bowls? What happened when they poured the seven bowls out? Bad stuff. Bad things happened. Yeah, bad things happened. And it wasn't bad for the followers of God, but it was very bad for the Roman Empire and the persecutors of Christians. So this is one of those same angels. That's the link that goes back into chapter 16. We see very clearly that this isn't an isolated kind of thing. This all goes back to chapter 16. We got one of these same angels that comes along and kind of drags John and says, "Let me show you something. Let me show you how bad this is going to get," and takes him out and shows this whole vision. Okay, the target of God's wrath in this is the great prostitute or harlot in some versions, and so she sits on many waters. You just read this description. She sits on many waters. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and often in the Bible, idolatry is characterized as adultery. And, you know, you can kind of see the natural link there, because you declare your allegiance to God, your lifetime allegiance to God, but then you turn around and start worshiping some other idol. And, you can see the similarity there. So it makes good sense. However, in this case, I want you to think about how kings would commit adultery with another political entity. In the ancient world particularly, they made a lot of treaties that were just treaties of convenience. They, you give your word, but you didn't really expect to keep your word for a long time. It's just in this temporary crisis or whatever the situation is. And everybody kind of understood that these treaties don't last very long. You know, it's just, this is kind of what we're doing right now. So they'd sign these treaties, but it really didn't have any, long-term commitment. If a better deal came along, well, that one's out the window, and we'll go with the better deal. They're very, very self-interested in that way. Anyway, regardless, the people of the earth just loved what was going on in verse 2. The inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. They just loved what was happening. So, that's kind of the description of what's going here, and you kind of stop and scratch your head and say, okay, what is all this about? And so you just step back and take a look at this description. There's this woman that's sitting on this scarlet beast, and we've already talked about this beast. Got blasphemous names and has 7 heads and 10 horns, and we pointed out in the past this is the same vision, same figure for the Roman Empire. This is the one we'd already talked about and got him identified pretty clearly. She's arrayed here in dazzling luxury, scarlet and purple and jewels and pearls. Why are pearls tossed in there? Did you know in the ancient world, the most valuable gemstone in the world was a pearl, not a diamond? Diamonds were okay, but pearls were really, if you really wanted to describe the most expensive gem in the ancient world, it would be a pearl, because they couldn't do synthetic pearls. They couldn't do artificial pearls. They couldn't do cultured pearls. You know, they do cultured pearls now. Just grab this oyster and stick a grain of sand in him, put him back in there, and he'll form the pearl in fairly short order. But in the ancient world, the only pearls that you found were the naturally occurring kind, and those are very rare and very irregular in shape. They're almost never round. They're usually some weird conglomerate shape. So that's why that word is thrown in here, pearls, to let you know that we're talking about the most luxurious, valuable thing that you can imagine. She's got all this pearls dripping over. By the way, the name pearl in Greek is Margaret. So if you know somebody named Margaret, that's just the Greek name for pearl. That was for free. No charge on that one. We'll move on. Okay, this woman is drinking from this golden cup that's filled with abominable things, and she's named, put a label on her there, Babylon the Great. Mother of prostitutes and abominations. Okay, that's probably not the sort of name most parents would give their daughter, but this is the name that she has. And she's drunk. And interestingly, the way this is written, it sounds like she's drunk all the time. She just never does sober up. She's just continually drunk all the time on the blood of the saints, the followers of Christ. Now, if you go and examine some of the literature on Revelation, you'll hear different fanciful explanations about what this prostitute stands for. What does this mean? Sometimes they'll say it's the actual literal city of Babylon, you know, over then in Iraq. They're actually going to rebuild that. Mosul, the city in Iraq that you read about from time to time. That's where Babylon is. And they're going to rebuild that thing, and that's going to be the signal for the end times, and you know what kind of hysteria comes on from there. Other people will say, no, it doesn't refer to that. Instead, it refers to the Roman Catholic Church. And they have this long, crazy explanation about what this all amounts to, a Roman Catholic Church. Both of those are completely nutty ideas, and it's just not possible. You know, the best way to get an identification of this is to read the rest of the passage and find out. You know, if God explains it to us, we don't have to hunt and worry about it and try to figure it out later. He makes it pretty plain. So let's go ahead and read the rest of this and discover what actually happens here. When I saw her, this is the end of verse 6, when I saw her, I was greatly astonished. Then the angel said to me, why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has the 7 heads and 10 horns. Boy, we can all just kind of sit back and go, that's nice. You know, we're going to get an explanation on this. I like that. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. Anybody remember the abyss, the bottomless pit? Anybody remember what that's associated with? The Satan's going to go out. He's going to go actually back, I guess, into the abyss. We'd already seen it opened one time and smoke boiled up out of there, and there was locusts that came out and stung people who didn't worship God, and it was really, really bad. Demonic influence there. Okay, so automatically we know this is a bad guy. He's on the opposite team. The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. I love that line. I quote it frequently because there's so much in life that calls for a mind with wisdom. Yeah, stop and think about this for a minute. The 7 heads are 7 hills on which the woman sits. They are also 7 kings. Okay, what is the woman, first of all? Is the woman a person or is the woman a city? City. Said Babylon the Great, right? It's a city. All right, so the woman sits on 7 hills. There are also 7 kings. Ooh, didn't think about that. 5 have fallen, 1 is, the other has not yet come, but when he does, he must remain for a little while. The beast who once was and now is not is an 8th king. He belongs to the 7 and is going to his destruction. The 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose, and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. Then the angel said to me, the waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. The beast and the 10 horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They'll eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. Okay. You know, those explanations are fairly long, but they're detailed and fairly clear. Okay, now, let's run through this again. The beast once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. And to understand this is difficult, and I do freely admit that you need to keep an open mind on this. However, it seems that phrase, once was, now is not, and will be later, is supposed to be a direct contrast to what was said about God at the very beginning of the book. He was and is to come. He is forever. You make no mistake, God is eternal. this city is not eternal. And what do they call Rome? The eternal city. Nope, sorry, it's not. It's not at all eternal. Okay, God is eternal, but the city is not. And at the same time, let's keep in mind that once in a while, it seems to us that evil is overthrown in the world. You look around and you think, wow, you know, we had this big problem, but now we got that taken care of. Whew, that's lucky, and now let's move on. And you have to realize that it keeps coming back on us. And never in this life will we be completely free of the influence of evil. That remains only for us in heaven. It's one of the things that makes heaven even sweeter. But throughout our lives, we're just going to have this continual problem. It'll look sometimes like we've got it conquered, taken care of. No, don't be free. Don't imagine that we're free of it completely. It's just not true. Okay, in addition, let's continue with this description here. This calls for wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills, and they're seven kings. And so five of these kings are dead or fallen. One is coming for a little while. And then the beast is an eighth king like the first seven and is going to be destroyed. Now, let me go through the list of Roman Caesars here. Julius doesn't count. Once in a while, people try to throw Julius Caesar in there. Sorry, he doesn't count. He was never an emperor. He was given the title Imperator, but very shortly, some guys had a problem with that, and he was assassinated, obviously. That plunged Rome into civil war, and it wasn't until 27 BC that Augustus was declared emperor and really made it stick. Okay, so he really made it stick there. After Augustus was Tiberius' adopted son. After that was Gaius, sometimes called Caligula, who was as crazy as he could be. Then was Claudius. Claudius was actually a pretty good Roman emperor, and as far as an administrator goes, and did a pretty good job overall. There was that one thing about kicking all the Jews out of Rome that happened in the year 49. And that's the one you can write in Acts 18 and say, okay, that happened in AD 49. And then Nero from 54 to 68 was the Caesar. Started out well, went crazy quickly, and then ultimately was assassinated. Well, he committed suicide, actually. And there was this myth that Nero wasn't really dead, but he would be coming back. And then, so that would be the five who had fallen. There was a very brief period. It was the year of the bad Caesars. Galba, Otho, and Vitellius came and went really quickly. All of them died violently. I think one of them was only in power for a month, something like that. And then Vespasian was recalled from his successful campaign in Judea. He was in the process of stomping out the Jewish revolt in Palestine when he was recalled to become Caesar in Rome. So he would have been the sixth king. His son Titus reigned for a little while, trust me, it was a little while, 79-81, and his brother Domitian assassinated him. Then Domitian took the throne as the eighth. So you can kind of see this progression of Caesars as they're going on. Domitian was one of the most corrupt emperors ever. Sometime we have more time, I'll give you a rundown of some more of that stuff. The ten horns. Okay, so that's the kings, that's the hills, and that's the kings. We'll talk about the hills here just in a few minutes. The ten horns represent ten minor kings. They reign for a very short time, give their power to the beast. Their purpose really is only to make war against the lamb. They're not at all important. They come to power and just immediately hand off their power to the Roman Empire and make war against the saints. That's their whole function, is to be allies of the beast. And they're overcome because the Lamb, Jesus, is Lord of Lords and King of Kings. You remember what that phrase means, Lord of Lords and King of Kings? You know how that works? Remember that in Hebrew, you can't say good, better, and best. So this is the way you develop superlatives. Lord of lords. Servant of servants is the bestest servant you can. He's the servantest guy you can get. Well, the Lord of lords is the lordest. I mean, he's the highest. King of kings is the kingest. I mean, he's top of the heap. You cannot get any better than that. So this description of Jesus as Lord of lords and King of kings really is designed to make everybody think absolute top. Total, there's just no possibility of anything higher than that. And with him will be his called and chosen and faithful followers. And then we're reminded that the waters represent people of all nations and languages, and the beast. This is odd, isn't it? The beast and the horns actually hate the prostitute. They're going to kill her. They're going to participate in the sacking and looting and destruction of Rome. And you'd think, why do they hate her? Aren't they all on the same team? Not really. You know, the thing about evil is it is truly evil. And evil is not partly good. So it is hateful and envious and jealous and vicious. And if there's no convenient target toward which it can be hateful and vicious, it'll turn on itself. Because it is hateful and vicious. It's what it does and who it is. So the beast and the kings are going to turn on the prostitute also. And interestingly, God is using them to execute his wrath. Okay, finally, the last thing here in verse, 18? The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. Okay, now, let's kind of sort this out. Okay, we're looking at a city. This woman is a city that rules over all the people on the earth right now, and there are other kings that give her power, and she's had five kings that are dead, and now there are others in line here, and she sits on seven hills. What city could that possibly be? There is only one. I double dog promise you, there is only one city that this describes in the entire ancient world. There's only one city, and that is Rome. There is not any other city that could be described with this description. The seven hills of Rome are notoriously famous. I mean, here's the list of them: the Quirinal, the Viminal, Esquiline, Caelian, Palatine, Capitoline, and Aventine. These are the seven hills of Rome. They have been the traditional seven hills of Rome long before the time of the empire. There is no other city that I'm aware of that sits on seven hills. Curiously, I have seen people who tried to point out that Jerusalem sits on seven hills. It does not. It never has sat on seven hills. The biggest Jerusalem has ever been in its history, you could kind of say it sat on three hills and a couple of small ridges. But there's no way you can build seven hills out of it. There's just no way. Rome, on the other hand, is very clearly identified. Sits on seven hills. This is the one that had authority over the whole world. This is notoriously rich and notoriously decadent. Persecuted the saints. Even the citizens of Rome, its loyal citizens, considered Rome to be a cesspool, really, of iniquity. Tacitus, the Roman historian who wrote about, I think, 117 or so, described it as the place where every vile and corrupt superstition in the world took root and flourished. Because it was a corrupt place. Just crazy. Now, as I read that and think about that, Connie and I just went on vacation. We went to a couple of national parks in southwestern Utah. We flew into Las Vegas. And I was just telling somebody, Las Vegas is an alternative universe, people. There is nothing quite like it. We were there before we got out of the airport. We're already thinking, we don't need to be here. We need to be someplace else in a hurry. I stupidly thought I could catch a nap in the airport. Do you know how hard it is to sleep with about 25 slot machines going right behind your head? You cannot get out of the airport. I don't suppose there's any public place in Nevada that doesn't have one or more slot machines going all the time. There's a sermon illustration there that's coming up. We won't worry about that right now. Anyway, every time I think of decadence, that's what's going to pop into my mind. Well, that's the way most people thought of Rome. It was just a truly horrible place to be. Now, when you grab onto that and realize that chapter 17 is about the city of Rome, then the rest of the book just continues to drop into place. It makes perfect sense. Once you see that this is talking about the persecution of Christians by the Roman Empire and God's subsequent destruction of Rome as judgment on this empire and this city for its persecution of saints, you know, the whole book just makes amazingly good sense then. But it depends, of course, on getting some of these keys firmly established in our minds so that we understand what's going on. Now, the early Christians, they wouldn't have the slightest bit of interest in a revelation from God that talked about things happening 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years in the future. That wouldn't interest them very much except as kind of a minor academic exercise. What they want to know is, why is all this bad stuff happening to us right now? We're supposed to be the good guys. I thought God was in charge of this world. I thought the kingdom was going to expand and just take over the world. You know, why is all this bad stuff happening? Well, this is the answer. There's warfare. We talked about that warfare that was going on. But then also, God is taking care of it. He is taking care of it. He's doing it in His timetable. He's doing it in His way. Don't get too excited about it. I mean, you know, it's hard not to get excited when it's your family that's being slaughtered. But at the same time, you realize that blessed are those who die in the Lord. So it's not really the most terrible thing that can happen. Okay, comments, questions, anything you want to know about chapter 17? Just a little bit under it is a place that they call Mars Hill, and that's where the philosophers got together. And they'd sit around, as Luke points out, they talked about nothing all day long except something new. They just wanted to hear something new. Any other comments, questions? All righty, y'all are just too easy to get along with. We're going to charge into chapter 18 next week, and there is an end in...